I could see his body jerking, convulsing, straining against the rope as his screaming went on and on. My stomach heaved, and I had to force myself to stay where I was and keep quiet. Why didn't they stop?
"Please, Master," the man begged. "For God's sake, Master, please."
I shut my eyes and tensed my muscles against an urge to vomit. I had seen people beaten on television and in the movies. I had seen the two red blood substitutes streaked across their backs and heard their well-rehearsed screams. But I hadn't lain nearby and smelled their sweat, or heard them pleading and praying, shamed before their families and themselves. I was probably less prepared for the reality than the child crying not far from me. In fact, she and I were reacting very much alike. My face, too, was wet with tears, and my mind was darting from one thought to another, trying to tune out the whipping. At one point, this last cowardice even brought me something useful. A name for whites who rode through the night in the antebellum South, breaking in doors and beating and otherwise torturing black people. Patrols. Groups of young whites who ostensibly maintained order among the slaves. Patrols. Forerunners of the Ku Klux Klan. The man's screaming stopped. After a moment, I looked up and saw that the patrollers were untying him. He continued to lean against the tree even when the rope was off him, until one of the patrollers pulled him around and tied his hands in front of him. Then, still holding the other end of the rope, the patroller mounted his horse and rode away, half dragging his captive behind him. The rest of the patrol mounted and followed, except for one who was having some kind of low-voiced discussion with the woman. Evidently, the discussion didn't go the way the man wanted, because before he rode after the others, he punched the woman in the face exactly as her husband had been punched earlier. The woman collapsed to the ground. The patroller rode away and left her there. The patrol and its stumbling captive headed back to the road, slanting off toward the Whalen house. If they had gone back exactly the way they came, they would have either gone over me or driven me from my cover. I was lucky and stupid for having gotten so close. I wondered whether the captive black man belonged to Tom Whalen. That might explain Rufus's friendship with the child, Alice. That is, if the child was Alice. If this was the right cabin. Whether it was or not, though, the woman, unconscious and abandoned, was in need of help. I got up and went over to her. The child, who had been kneeling beside her, jumped up to run away. "Alice," I called softly. She stopped, peered at me through the darkness. She was Alice then. These people were my relatives, my ancestors. And this place could be my refuge. 4. "I'm a friend, Alice," I said as I knelt and turned the unconscious woman's head to a more comfortable-looking position. Alice watched me uncertainly, then spoke in a small, whispery voice. "She dead?" I looked up. The child was younger than Rufus, dark and slender and small. She wiped her nose on her sleeve and sniffed. "No, she's not dead. Is there water in the house?" "Yeah." "Go get me some." She ran into the cabin and returned a few seconds later with a gourd dipper of water. I wet the mother's face a little, washed blood from around her nose and mouth. From what I could see of her, she seemed to be about my age, slender like her child, like me, in fact. And like me, she was fine-boned, probably not as strong as she needed to be to survive in this era. But she was surviving, however painfully. Maybe she would help me learn how. She regained consciousness slowly, first moaning, then crying out, "Alice! Alice!" "Mama?" said the child tentatively. The woman's eyes opened wider, and she stared at me.
Who are you?
A friend. I came here to ask for help, but right now I'd rather give it. When you feel able to get up, I'll help you inside.
I said, who are you?
Her voice hardened. My name is Dana. I'm a free woman. I was on my knees beside her now, and I saw her look at my blouse, my pants, my shoes, which for unpacking and working around the house happened to be an old pair of desert boots. She took a good look at me, then judged me.
A runaway, you mean?
That's what the patrollers would say, because I have no papers. But I'm free. Born free, intending to stay free.
You'll get me in trouble.
Not tonight. You've already had your trouble for tonight. I hesitated, bit my lip, then said softly, please don't turn me away. The woman said nothing for several seconds. I saw her glance over at her daughter, then touch her own face and wipe away blood from the corner of her mouth.
Wasn't going to turn you away, she said softly.
Thank you. I helped her up and into the cabin. Refuge, then. A few hours of peace. Perhaps tomorrow night I could go on behaving like a runaway this woman thought I was. Perhaps from her I could learn the quickest, safest way north. The cabin was dark except for a dying fire in the fireplace, but the woman made her way to her bed without trouble.
Alice,
she called out.
Here I am, Mama.
Put a log on the fire.
I watched the child obey, her long gown hanging dangerously near hot coals. Rufus's friend was at least as careless with fire as he was. Rufus. His name brought back all my fear and confusion and longing to go home. Would I really have to go all the way to some northern state to find peace? And if I did, what kind of peace would it be? The restricted North was better for blacks than the slave South, but not much better.
Why did you come here? The woman asked. Who sent you?
I stared into the fire, frowning. I could hear her moving around behind me, probably putting on clothing. The boy, I said softly. Rufus Whalen. The small noises stopped. There was silence for a moment. I knew I had taken a risk telling her about Rufus. Probably a foolish risk. I wondered why I had done it. No one knows about me but him, I continued. The fire began to flare up around Alice's small log. The log cracked and sputtered and filled the silence until Alice said,
Mr. Roof won't tell.
She shrugged.
He never tells nothing.
And there in her words was a reason for the risk I had taken. I hadn't thought of it until now, but if Rufus was one to tell what he shouldn't, Alice's mother should know so she could either hide me or send me away. I waited to see what she would say.
You sure the father didn't see you?
She asked, and that had to mean that she agreed with Alice, that Rufus was all right. Tom Whalen had probably marked his son more than he knew with that whip. Would I be here if the father had seen me? I asked.
Guess not.
I turned to look at her. She wore a gown now, long and white like her daughter's. She sat on the edge of the bed watching me. There was a table near me made of thick, smooth planks, and a bench made from a section of split log. I sat down on the bench. Does Tom Whalen own your husband? I asked. She nodded sadly.
You saw?
Yes.
He shouldn't have come. I told him not to.
Did he really have a pass? She gave a bitter laugh.
No. He won't get one either. Not to come see me. Mr. Tom said for him to choose a new wife there on the plantation. That way Mr. Tom will own all his children.
I looked at Alice. The woman followed my gaze.
He'll never own a child of mine, she said flatly.
I wondered. They seemed so vulnerable here. I doubted that this was their first visit from the patrol or their last. In a place like this, how could the woman be sure of anything? And then there was history. Rufus and Alice would get together somehow.
Where are you from? Asked the woman suddenly. The way you talk, you not from round here.
The new subject caught me by surprise, and I almost said Los Angeles. New York, I lied quietly. In 1815, California was nothing more than a distant Spanish colony, a colony this woman had probably never heard of.
That's a long way off, said the woman.
My husband is there. Where had that lie come from? And I had said it with all the longing I felt for Kevin, who was now too far away for me to reach through any effort of my own. The woman came over and stood staring down at me. She looked tall and straight and grim and years older.
They carried you off? She asked.
Yes. Maybe in a way I had been kidnapped.
You sure they didn't get him, too?
Just me. I'm sure.
And now you going back?
Yes. Fiercely. Hopefully. Yes. Lie and truth had merged. There was silence. The woman looked at her daughter, then back at me.
You stay here until tomorrow night, she said. Then there's another place you can head for. They'll let you have some food and...
Oh! She looked contrite.
You must be hungry now. I'll get you some.
No, I'm not hungry. Just tired.
Get into bed, then.
Alice, you too.
There's room for all of us there now.
She went to the child and began brushing off some of the dirt Alice had brought in from outside. I saw her close her eyes for a moment, then glance at the door.
Dana. You said your name was Dana?
Yes.
I forgot the blanket, she said. I left it outside when... I left it outside.
I'll get it, I said. I went to the door and looked outside. The blanket lay where the patroller had thrown it, on the ground not far from the house. I went over to pick it up, but just as I reached it, someone grabbed me and swung me around. Suddenly I was facing a young white man, broad-faced, dark-haired, stocky and about half a foot taller than I was.
What in hell?
He sputtered.
You're not the one.
He peered at me as though he wasn't sure. Apparently I looked enough like Alice's mother to confuse him, briefly.
Who are you?
He demanded.
What are you doing here?
What to do? He held me easily, barely noticing my efforts to pull away. I live here, I lied. What are you doing here? I thought he'd be more likely to believe me if I sounded indignant. Instead, he slapped me stunningly with one hand while he held me with the other. He spoke very softly.
You got no manners, nigger. I'll teach you some.
I said nothing. My ears still rang from his blow, but I heard him say,
You could be her sister. Her twin sister, almost.
That seemed to be a good thing for him to think, so I kept silent. Silence seemed safest, anyway.
Her sister dressed up like a boy.
He began to smile.
Her runaway sister. I wonder what you worth.
I panicked. Having him catch and hold me was bad enough. Now he meant to turn me in as a runaway. I dug the nails of my free hand into his arm and tore the flesh from elbow to wrist. Surprise and pain made the man loosen his grip on me slightly, and I wrenched away. I heard him yell, heard him start after me. I ran mindlessly toward the cabin door only to find Alice's mother there barring my way. Don't come in here, she whispered. Please don't come in here. I had no chance to go in. The man caught me, pulled me backward, threw me to the ground. He would have kicked me, but I rolled aside and jumped to my feet. Terror gave me speed and agility I never knew I had. Again I ran, this time for the trees. I didn't know where I was going, but the sounds of the man behind me sent me zigzagging on. Now I longed for darker, denser woods that I could lose myself in. The man tackled me and brought me down hard. At first I lay stunned, unable to move or defend myself, even when he began hitting me, punching me with his fists. I had never been beaten that way before. Would never have thought I could absorb so much punishment without losing consciousness. When I tried to scramble away, he pulled me back. When I tried to push him away, he hardly seemed to notice. At one point, I did get his attention, though. He had leaned down close to me, pinning me flat on my back. I raised my hands to his face, my fingers partly covering his eyes. In that instant, I knew I could stop him, cripple him in his primitive age, destroy him. His eyes. I only had to move my fingers a little and jab them into the soft tissues, gouge away his sight, and give him more agony than he was giving me. But I couldn't do it. The thought sickened me, froze my hands where they were. I had to do it, but I couldn't. The man knocked my hands from his face and moved back from me, and I cursed myself for my utter stupidity. My chance was gone, and I'd done nothing. My squeamishness belonged in another age, but I'd brought it along with me. Now I would be sold into slavery because I didn't have the stomach to defend myself in the most effective way. Slavery. And there was a more immediate threat. The man had stopped beating me. Now he simply kept a tight hold on me and looked at me. I could see I had left a few scratches on his face. Shallow, insignificant scratches. The man rubbed his hand across them, looked at the blood, then looked at me. "You know you're gonna pay for that, don't you?" he said. I said nothing. Stupidity was what I would pay for, if anything. "I guess you'd do as well as your sister," he said. "I came back for her, but you're just like her." That told me who he probably was. One of the patrollers. The one who had hit Alice's mother, probably. He reached out and ripped my blouse open. Buttons flew everywhere, but I didn't move. I understood what the man was going to do. He was going to display some stupidity of his own. He was going to give me another chance to destroy him. I was almost relieved. He tore loose my bra, and I prepared to move. Just one quick lunge. Then suddenly, for no reason that I could see, he reared above me, fists drawn back to hit me again. I jerked my head aside, hit it on something hard just as his fist glanced off my jaw. The new pain shattered my resolve, sent me scrambling away again. I was only able to move a few inches before he pinned me down, but that was far enough for me to discover that the thing I had hit my head on was a heavy stick, a tree limb perhaps. I grasped it with both hands and brought it down as hard as I could on his head. He collapsed across my body. I lay still, panting, trying to find the strength to get up and run. The man had a horse around somewhere, if I could find it. I dragged myself from beneath his heavy body and tried to stand up. Halfway up, I felt myself losing consciousness, falling back. I caught hold of a tree and willed myself to stay conscious. If the man came to and found me nearby, he would kill me. But I couldn't keep my hold on the tree. I fell, slowly it seemed, into a deep, starless darkness. 5. Pain dragged me back to consciousness. At first, it was all I was aware of. Every part of my body hurt. Then I saw a blurred face above me, the face of a man, and I panicked. I scrambled away, kicking him, clawing the hands that reached out for me, trying to bite, lunging up toward his eyes. I could do it now. I could do anything.
Dana!
I froze. My name? No patroller would know that.
Dana, look at me, for God's sake!
Kevin! It was Kevin's voice. I stared upward, managed to focus on him clearly at last. I was at home. I was lying on my own bed, bloody and dirty, but safe. Safe! Kevin lay half on top of me, holding me, smearing himself with my blood and his own. I could see where I had scratched his face so near the eye. Kevin, I'm sorry.
Are you all right now?
Yes. I thought you were the patroller.
The what?
I'll tell you later. God, I hurt. And I'm so tired. But it doesn't matter. I'm home.
You were gone 2 or 3 minutes this time. I didn't know what to think. You don't know how good it is to have you back again.
2 or 3 minutes?
Almost 3 minutes. I watched the clock, but it seemed to be longer.
I closed my eyes in pain and weariness. It hadn't just seemed longer to me. I had been gone for hours, and I knew it. But at that moment, I couldn't have argued it. I couldn't have argued anything. The surge of strength that helped me to fight when I thought I was fighting for my life was gone.
"I'm going to take you to the hospital," said Kevin. "I don't know how I'm going to explain you, but you need help."
"No." He got up. I felt him lift me. "No, Kevin, please."
"Listen, don't be afraid. I'll be with you."
"No." "Look, all he did was hit me a few times. I'll be all right." Suddenly I had strength again, now that I needed it. "Kevin, I went from here the first time and this second time, and I came back here. What will happen if I go from the hospital and come back there?"
"Probably nothing."
But he had stopped.
"No one who sees you leave or come back will believe it. And they wouldn't dare tell anybody."
"Please, just let me sleep. That's all I need, really. Rest. The cuts and bruises will heal. I'll be fine." He took me back to the bed, probably against his better judgment, and put me down.
"How long was it for you?" he asked.
"Hours. But it was only bad at the end."
"Who did this to you?"
"A patroller. He thought I was a runaway." I frowned. "I have to sleep, Kevin. I'll make more sense in the morning, I promise." My voice trailed away.
"Dana?"
I jumped, tried to refocus my attention on him.
"Did he rape you?"
I sighed. "No. I hit him with a stick, knocked him out." "Let me sleep." "Wait a minute." I seemed to drift away from him. It became too much trouble for me to go on listening and trying to understand, too much trouble to answer. I sighed again and closed my eyes. I heard him get up and go away, heard water running somewhere. Then I slept. 6. I was clean when I awoke before dawn the next morning. I was wearing an old flannel nightgown that I hadn't worn since Kevin and I were married, and that I'd never worn in June. On one side of me was a canvas tote bag containing a pair of pants, a blouse, underclothing, a sweater, shoes, and the biggest switchblade knife I had ever seen. The tote bag was tied to my waist with a length of cord. On the other side of me lay Kevin, still asleep. But he woke up when I kissed him.
"You're still here," he said with obvious relief.
And he hugged me, reminding me painfully of a few bruises. Then he remembered, let me go, and switched on the light.
"How do you feel?"
"Pretty well." I sat up, got out of bed, managed to stand up for a moment. Then I got back under the cover. "I'm healing."
"Good. You're rested, you're healing. Now you can tell me what the hell happened to you, and what's a patroller? All I could think of was the highway patrol.
I thought back to my reading.
A patroller was a white man, usually young, often poor, sometimes drunk. He was a member of a group of such men organized to keep the blacks in line.
What?
Patrollers made sure the slaves were where they were supposed to be at night, and they punished those who weren't. They chased down runaways for a fee, and sometimes they just raised hell, had a little fun terrorizing people who weren't allowed to fight back.
Kevin leaned on one elbow and looked down at me.
What are you talking about?
Where were you?
In Maryland. Somewhere on the eastern shore, if I understood Rufus.
Maryland? 3,000 miles away in what? A few minutes?
More than 3,000 miles. More than any number of miles. I moved to relieve pressure on an especially tender bruise. Let me tell you all of it. I remembered it for him in detail as I had the first time. Again, he listened without interrupting. This time, when I finished, he just shook his head.
This is getting crazier and crazier, he muttered.
Not to me. He glanced at me sidelong. To me, it's getting more and more believable. I don't like it. I don't want to be in the middle of it. I don't understand how it can be happening, but it's real. It hurts too much not to be. And my ancestors, for God's sake.
Maybe.
Kevin, I can show you the old Bible.
But the fact is, you had already seen the Bible,
knew about those people, knew their names, knew they were Marylanders, knew...
What the hell is that supposed to prove? That I was just hallucinating and weaving in the names of my ancestors? I'd like to give you some of this pain that I must still be hallucinating.
He put an arm over my chest, resting it on unbruised flesh. After a while, he said, Do you honestly believe you traveled back over a century in time and crossed 3,000 miles of space to see your dead ancestors? I moved uncomfortably.
Yes, I whispered.
No matter how it sounds, no matter what you think, it happened. And you're not helping me deal with it by laughing.
I'm not laughing.
They were my ancestors. Even that damn parasite, the patroller, saw the resemblance between me and Alice's mother.
He said nothing.
I'll tell you. I wouldn't dare act as though they weren't my ancestors. I wouldn't let anything happen to them, the boy or girl, if I could possibly prevent it.
You wouldn't anyway.
Kevin, take this seriously, please.
I am. Anything I can do to help you, I'll do.
Believe me.
He sighed. It's like you just said.
What?
I wouldn't dare act as though I didn't believe. After all, when you vanish from here, you must go someplace. If that place is where you think it is, back to the antebellum South, then we've got to find a way to protect you while you're there.
I moved closer to him, relieved, content with even such grudging acceptance. He had become my anchor. Suddenly my tie to my own world. He couldn't have known how much I needed him firmly on my side.
I'm not sure it's possible for a lone black woman or even a black man to be protected in that place, I said.
But if you have an idea, I'll be glad to hear it.
He said nothing for several seconds. Then he reached over me into the canvas bag and brought out the switchblade.
This might improve your chances if you can bring yourself to use it.
I've seen it.
Can you use it?
You mean, will I use it?
Well, that too.
Yes.
Before last night, I might not have been sure, but now, yes.
He got up, left the room for a moment, and came back with two wooden rulers.
Show me, he said.
I untied the cord of the canvas bag and got up, discovering sore muscles as I moved. I limped over to him, took one of the rulers, looked at it, rubbed my face groggily, and in a sudden slashing motion drew the ruler across his abdomen just as he was opening his mouth to speak.
That's it, I said.
He frowned.
Kevin, I'm not going to be in any fair fights. He said nothing. You understand? I'm a poor, dumb, scared nigger until I get my chance. They won't even see the knife if I have my way. Not until it's too late. He shook his head. What else don't I know about you? I shrugged and got back into bed. I've been watching the violence of this time go by on the screen long enough to have picked up a few things. Glad to hear it. It doesn't matter much. He sat down next to where I lay. What do you mean? That most of the people around Rufus know more about real violence than the screenwriters of today will ever know. That's debatable. I just can't make myself believe I can survive in that place. Not with a knife, not even with a gun. He took a deep breath. Look, if you're drawn back there again, what can you do but try to survive? You're not going to just let them kill you. Oh, they won't kill me. Not unless I'm silly enough to resist the other things they'd rather do, like raping me, throwing me into jail as a runaway, and then selling me to the highest bidder when they see that my owner isn't coming to claim me. I rubbed my forehead. I almost wish I hadn't read about it. But it doesn't have to happen that way. There were free blacks. You could pose as one of them. Free blacks had papers to prove they were free. You could have papers, too. We could forge something. If we knew what to forge. I mean, a certificate of freedom is what we need, but I don't know what they looked like. I've read about them, but I've never seen one. He got up and went to the living room. Moments later, he came back and dumped an armload of books on the bed. I brought everything we had on black history, he said. Start hunting. There were 10 books. We checked indexes and even leafed through some of the books page by page to be sure. Nothing. I hadn't really thought there would be anything in these books. I hadn't read them all, but I'd at least glanced through them before. We'll have to go to the library then, said Kevin. We'll go today as soon as it's open. If I'm still here when it opens. He put the books on the floor and got back under the cover. Then he lay there frowning at me. What about the pass Alice's father was supposed to have? A pass? Well, that was just written permission for a slave to be somewhere other than at home at a certain time.
Sounds like just a note.
It is, I said. You've got it. One of the reasons it was against the law in some states to teach slaves to read and write was that they might escape by writing themselves passes. Some did escape that way. I got up, went to Kevin's office and took a small scratch pad and a new pen from his desk and the large atlas from his bookcase. I'm going to tear Maryland out, I told him as I returned.
Go ahead. I wish I had a road atlas for you. The roads in it wouldn't exist in those days, but it might show you the easiest way through the country.
This one shows main highways, shows a lot of rivers, too, and in 1815 there were probably not many bridges. I looked closely at it, then got up again.
What now? Asked Kevin.
Encyclopedia. I want to see when the Pennsylvania Railroad built this nice long track through the peninsula. I'd have to go into Delaware to pick it up, but it would take me right into Pennsylvania.
Forget it, he said. 1815 is too early for railroads.
I looked anyway and found that the Pennsylvania Railroad hadn't even begun until 1846. I went back to bed and stuffed the pen, the map, and the scratch pad into my canvas bag.
Tie that cord around you again, said Kevin.
I obeyed silently.
I think we may have missed something, he said.
Getting home may be simpler for you than you realize. Getting home? Here?
Here. You may have more control over your returning than you think.
I don't have any control at all.
You might.
Listen, remember the rabbit or whatever it was that you said ran across the road in front of you?
Yes.
It scared you.
Terrified me. For a second I thought it was,
I don't know, something dangerous.
And your fear made you dizzy, and you thought you were coming home.
Does fear usually make you dizzy?
No. I don't think it did this time either. At least not in any normal way.
I think you were right. You did almost come home. Your fear almost sent you home. But I was afraid the whole time I was there. And I was scared half out of my mind while the patroller was beating me. But I didn't come home until I'd knocked him out, saved myself.
Not too helpful.
No.
But look, was your fight with the patroller really over? You said you were afraid that if he found you there, passed out, he'd kill you.
He would have, for revenge. I fought back, actually hurt him. I can't believe he let me get away with that.
You may be right.
I am right.
The point is, you believe you are.
Kevin,
wait! Hear me out. You believed your life was in danger, that the patroller would kill you. And on your last trip, you believed your life was in danger when you found Rufus's father aiming a rifle at you.
Yes.
And even with the animal, you mistook it for something dangerous.
But I saw it in time, just as a dark blur, but clearly enough to see that it was small and harmless.
And I see what you're saying, that you might have been better off if your animal had been a snake. Your danger, then, or assumed danger, might have sent you home before you ever met the patroller.
Then, Rufus's fear of death calls me to him, and my own fear of death sends me home.
So it seems.
That doesn't really help, you know?
It could.
Think about it, Kevin. If the thing I'm afraid of isn't really dangerous, a rabbit instead of a snake, then I stay where I am. If it is dangerous, it's liable to kill me before I get home. Going home does take a while, you know. I have to get through the dizziness, the nausea.
Seconds.
Seconds count when something is trying to kill you. I wouldn't dare put myself in danger in the hope of getting home before the axe fell. And if I got into trouble by accident, I wouldn't dare just wait passively to be saved. I might wind up coming home in pieces.
Yes. I see your point.
I sighed. So the more I think about it, the harder it is for me to believe I could survive even a few more trips to a place like that. There's just too much that could go wrong.
Will you stop that?
Look, your ancestors survived that era. Survived it with fewer advantages than you have. You're no less than they are.
In a way, I am.
What way?
Strength. Endurance.
To survive, my ancestors had to put up with more than I ever could. Much more. You know what I mean?
No, I don't, he said with annoyance. You're working yourself into a mood that could be suicidal if you're not careful.
Oh, but I am talking about suicide, Kevin. Suicide or worse. For instance, I would have used your knife against that patroller last night if I'd had it. I would have killed him. That would have ended the immediate danger to me, and I probably wouldn't have come home. But if that patroller's friends had caught me, they would have killed me. And if they hadn't caught me, they would probably have gone after Alice's mother. They may have, anyway. So either I would have died, or I would have caused another innocent person to die. But the patroller was trying to...
He stopped, looked at me.
I see.
Good.
There was a long silence. He pulled me closer to him.
Do I really look like that patroller?
No.
Do I look like someone you can come home to from where you may be going?
I need you here to come home to. I've already learned that. He gave me a long, thoughtful look.
Just keep coming home, he said finally. I need you here, too.
The Fall.
1. I think Kevin was as lonely and out of place as I was when I met him, though he was handling it better. But then he was about to escape. I was working out of a casual labor agency. We regulars called it a slave market. Actually, it was just the opposite of slavery. The people who ran it couldn't have cared less whether or not you showed up to do the work they offered. They always had more job hunters than jobs anyway. If you wanted them to think about using you, you went to their office around 6 in the morning, signed in, and sat down to wait. Waiting with you were winos trying to work themselves into a few more bottles, poor women trying to supplement their welfare checks, kids trying to get a first job, older people who'd lost one job too many, and usually a poor, crazy old street lady who talked to herself constantly and who wasn't going to be hired no matter what because she only wore one shoe. You sat and sat until the dispatcher either sent you out on a job or sent you home. Home meant no money. Put another potato in the oven. Or, in desperation, sell some blood at one of the storefronts down the street from the agency. I had only done that once. Getting sent out meant the minimum wage, minus Uncle Sam's share, for as many hours as you were needed. You swept floors, stuffed envelopes, took inventory, washed dishes, sorted potato chips. Really? Cleaned toilets, marked prices on merchandise. You did whatever you were sent out to do. It was nearly always mindless work, and as far as most employers were concerned, it was done by mindless people. Non-people rented for a few hours, a few days, a few weeks. It didn't matter. I did the work. I went home, I ate, and then slept for a few hours. Finally, I got up and wrote. At 1 or 2 in the morning, I was fully awake, fully alive, and busy working on my novel. During the day, I carried a little box of no-dos. I kept awake with them, but not very wide awake. The first thing Kevin ever said to me was, "Why do you go around looking like a zombie all the time?" He was just one of several regular employees at an auto parts warehouse where a group of us from the agency were doing an inventory. I was wandering around between shelves of nuts, bolts, chrome, and heaven knew what else, checking other people's work. I had a habit of showing up every day and of being able to count, so the supervisor decided that, zombie or not, I should check the others. He was right. People came in after a hard night of drinking and counted 5 units per clearly marked 50-unit container. "Zombie?" I repeated, looking up from the tray of short black wires at Kevin. "You look like you sleepwalk through the day," he said. "Are you high on something or what?" He was just a stock helper or some such bottom-of-the-ladder type. He had no authority over me, and I didn't owe him any explanations. "I do my work," I said quietly. I turned back to the wires, counted them, corrected the inventory slip, initialed it, and moved down to the next shelf. "Buzz told me you were a writer," said the voice that I thought had gone away. "Look, I can't count with you talking to me." I pulled out a tray full of large screws, 25 to a box. "Take a break. Did you see that agency guy they sent home yesterday? He took one break too many. Unfortunately, I need this job. Are you a writer?" "I'm a joke, as far as Buzz is concerned. He thinks people are strange if they even read books. Besides," I added bitterly, "what would a writer be doing working out of a slave market?" "Keeping yourself in rent and hamburgers, I guess. That's what I'm doing working at a warehouse." I woke up a little then and really looked at him. He was an unusual-looking white man, his face young, almost unlined, but his hair completely gray, and his eyes so pale as to be almost colorless. He was muscular, well-built, but no taller than my own 5'8", so that I found myself looking directly into the strange eyes. I looked away startled, wondering whether I had really seen anger there. Maybe he was more important in the warehouse than I had thought. Maybe he had some authority. "Are you a writer?" I asked. "I am now," he said, and he smiled. "Just sold a book. I'm getting out of here for good on Friday." I stared at him with a terrible mixture of envy and frustration. "Congratulations." "Look," he said, still smiling, "it's almost lunchtime. Eat with me. I want to hear about what you're writing." And he was gone. I hadn't said yes or no, but he was gone. "Hey," whispered another voice behind me. "Buzz." The agency clown when he was sober. Wine put him into some kind of trance, though, and he just sat and stared and looked retarded, which he wasn't quite. He just didn't give a damn about anything, including himself, He drank up his pay and walked around in rags. Also, he never bathed.
"Hey, you two gonna get together and write some books?" he asked, leering.
"Get out of here."
"You gonna write some pornography together?"
He went away laughing. Later, at one of the round, rusting metal tables in the corner of the warehouse that served as the lunch area, I found out more about my new writer friend. Kevin Franklin, his name was, and he'd not only gotten his book published, but he'd made a big paperback sale. He could live on the money while he wrote his next book. He could give up shit work, hopefully forever.
"Why aren't you eating?"
he asked when he stopped for breath. The warehouse was in a newly built industrial section of Compton, far enough from coffee shops and hot dog stands to discourage most of us from going out to eat. Some people brought their lunches. Others brought them from the catering truck. I had done neither. All I was having was a cup of the free dishwater coffee available to all the warehouse workers. "I'm on a diet," I said. He stared at me for a moment, then got up, motioned me up.
"Come on."
"Where?"
"To the truck, if it's still there."
"Wait a minute, you don't have to..."
"Listen, I've been on that kind of diet."
"I'm all right," I lied, embarrassed. "I don't want anything." He left me sitting there, went to the truck, and came back with a hamburger, milk, a small wedge of apple pie.
"Eat," he said. "I'm still not rich enough to waste money, so eat."
To my own surprise, I ate. I hadn't intended to. I was caffeine jittery and surly and perfectly capable of wasting his money. After all, I told him not to spend it. But I ate.
Buzz sidled by. "Hey," he said low-voiced. "Porn."
He moved on.
"What?" said Kevin.
"Nothing," I said. "He's crazy." Then, "Thanks for the lunch."
"Sure. Now tell me what it is you write."
"Short story so far, but I'm working on a novel."
"Naturally."
"Have any of your stories sold?"
"Some. To little magazines no one ever heard of. The kind that pay in copies of the magazine."
He shook his head.
"You're going to starve."
"No."
"After a while, I'll convince myself that my aunt and uncle were right."
"About what?"
"That you should have been an accountant."
I surprised myself again by laughing aloud. The food was reviving me.
"They didn't think of accounting," I said. "But they would have approved of it.
It's what they call sensible. They wanted me to be a nurse, a secretary, or a teacher like my mother. At the very best, a teacher."
"Yes," he sighed. "I was supposed to be an engineer myself."
"That's better, at least."
"Not to me."
"Well, anyway, now you have proof that you were right." He shrugged and didn't tell me what he would later. That his parents, like mine, were dead. They had died years before in an auto accident, still hoping that he might come to his senses and become an engineer. "My aunt and uncle said I could write in my spare time if I wanted to," I told him. "Meanwhile, for the real future, I was to take something sensible in school if I expected them to support me. I went from the nursing program into a secretarial major and from there to elementary education. All in 2 years. It was pretty bad. So was I."
"What did you do?" he asked. "Flunk out?"
I choked on a piece of pie crust.
"Of course not. I always got good grades. They just didn't mean anything to me. I couldn't manufacture enough interest in the subjects to keep me going.
Finally, I got a job, moved away from home, and quit school. I still take extension classes at UCLA, though, when I can afford them. Writing classes."
"Is this the job you got?"
"No. I worked for a while at an aerospace company. I was just a clerk typist, but I talked my way into the publicity office. I was doing articles for their company newspaper and press releases to send out. They were glad to have me do it once I showed them I could. They had a writer for the price of a clerk typist."
"Sounds like something you could have stayed with and moved up."
"I meant to.
Ordinary clerical work I couldn't stand, but that was good. Then about a year ago, they laid off the whole department.
He laughed, but it sounded like sympathetic laughter.
Buzz, coming back from the coffee machine, muttered,
"Chocolate and vanilla porn."
I closed my eyes in exasperation. He always did that. Started a joke that wasn't funny to begin with, then beat it to death. God, I wish he'd get drunk and shut up.
"Does getting drunk shut him up?" asked Kevin.
I nodded. Nothing else will do it. No matter. I heard what he said this time.
The bell rang, ending the lunch half hour, and he grinned. He had a grin that completely destroyed the effect of his eyes. Then he got up and left. But he came back. He came back all week, at breaks, at lunch.
My daily drawback at the agency gave me money enough to buy my own lunches and pay my landlady a few dollars, but I still looked forward to seeing him, talking to him. He had written and published 3 novels, he told me, and outside members of his family, he'd never met anyone who'd read one of them. They'd brought so little money that he'd gone on taking mindless jobs like this one at the warehouse, and he'd gone on writing, unreasonably against the advice of saner people. He was like me, a kindred spirit crazy enough to keep on trying. And now, finally,
"I'm even crazier than you," he said. "After all, I'm older than you. Old enough to recognize failure and stop dreaming, so I'm told."
He was a prematurely gray 34. He had been surprised to learn that I was only 22.
"You look older," he said tactlessly.
"So do you," I muttered. He laughed.
"I'm sorry, but at least it looks good on you."
I wasn't sure what it was that looked good on me, but I was glad he liked it. His likes and dislikes were becoming important to me. One of the women from the agency told me with typical slave market candor that he and I were the weirdest-looking couple she had ever seen. I told her, not too gently, that she hadn't seen much and that it was none of her business anyway. But from then on, I thought of Kevin and I as a couple. It was pleasant thinking. My time at the warehouse and his job there ended on the same day. Buzz's matchmaking had given us a week together.
"Listen," said Kevin on the last day, "you like plays?"
"Plays? Sure. I wrote a couple while I was in high school. One actor's pretty bad.
I did something like that myself."
He took something from his pocket and held it out to me. Tickets. 2 tickets to a hit play that had just come to Los Angeles. I think my eyes glittered.
"I don't want you to get away from me just because we won't be co-workers anymore," he said.
"Tomorrow evening?"
"Tomorrow evening," I agreed.
It was a good evening. I brought him home with me when it was over, and the night was even better. Sometime during the early hours of the next morning, when we lay together, tired and content in my bed, I realized that I knew less about loneliness than I had thought, and much less than I would know when he went away.
2.
I decided not to go to the library with Kevin to look for forgeable free papers. I was worried about what might happen if Rufus called me from the car while it was moving. Would I arrive in his time still moving but without the car to protect me? Or would I arrive safe and still but have trouble when I returned home because this time the home I returned to might be in the middle of a busy street? I didn't want to find out. So while Kevin got ready to go to the library, I sat on the bed, fully dressed, stuffing a comb, a brush, and a bar of soap into my canvas bag. I was afraid I might be trapped in Rufus's time for a longer period if I went again. My first trip had lasted only a few minutes, my second a few hours. What was next? Days? Kevin came in to tell me he was going. I didn't want him to leave me alone, but I thought I had done enough whining for one morning. I kept my fear to myself, or I thought I did.
"You feel all right?" he asked me.
"You don't look so good." I had just had my first look in the mirror since the beating, and I didn't think I looked so good either.
I opened my mouth to reassure him, but before I could get the words out, I realized that something really was wrong. The room was beginning to darken and spin. "Oh, no," I moaned. I closed my eyes against the sickening dizziness. Then I sat hugging the canvas bag and waiting. Suddenly, Kevin was beside me, holding me. I tried to push him away. I was afraid for him without knowing why. I shouted for him to let me go. Then the walls around me and the bed beneath me vanished. I lay sprawled on the ground under a tree. Kevin lay beside me, still holding me. Between us was the canvas bag. "Oh, God," I muttered, sitting up. Kevin sat up, too, and looked around wildly. We were in the woods again, and it was day this time. The country was much like what I remembered from my first trip, though there was no river in sight this time.
"It happened," said Kevin. "It's real."
I took his hand and held it, glad of its familiarity. And yet I wished he were back at home. In this place, he was probably better protection for me than free papers would have been. But I didn't want him here. I didn't want this place to touch him except through me. But it was too late for that. I looked around for Rufus, knowing that he must be nearby. He was. And the moment I saw him, I knew I was too late to get him out of trouble this time. He was lying on the ground, his body curled in a small knot, his hands clutching one leg. Beside him was another boy, black, about 12 years old. All Rufus's attention seemed to be on his leg, but the other boy had seen us. He might even have seen us appear from nowhere. That might be why he looked so frightened now. I stood up and went over to Rufus. He didn't see me at first. His face was twisted with pain and streaked with tears and dirt, but he wasn't crying aloud. Like the black boy, he looked about 12 years old. "Rufus?" He looked up, startled. "Dana?" "Yes." I was surprised that he recognized me after the years that had passed for him.
"I saw you again," he said. "You were on a bed. Just as I started to fall, I saw you."
"You did more than just see me," I said.
"I fell. My leg." "Who are you?" demanded the other boy. "She's all right, Nigel," said Rufus. "She's the one I told you about, the one who put out the fire that time."
Nigel looked at me, then back at Rufus.
"Can she fix your leg?"
Rufus looked at me questioningly. "I doubt it," I said, "but let me see anyway." I moved his hands away and as gently as I could, pulled his pants leg up. His leg was discolored and swollen. "Can you move your toes?" I asked. He tried, managed to move 2 toes feebly. "It's broken," commented Kevin. He had come closer to look. "Yes." I looked at the other boy, Nigel. "Where'd he fall from?"
"There."
The boy pointed upward. There was a tree limb hanging high above us. A broken tree limb. "You know where he lives?" I asked.
"Sure. I live there, too."
The boy was probably a slave, I realized, the property of Rufus's family.
"You sure do talk funny," said Nigel.
"Matter of opinion," I said.
"Look, if you care what happens to Rufus, you better go tell his father to send a wagon for him. He won't be walking anywhere."
"He could lean on me."
"No. The best way for him to go home is flat on his back. The least painful way, anyhow. You go tell Rufus's father that Rufus broke his leg. Tell him to send for the doctor. We'll stay with Rufus until you get back with the wagon."
"You?"
He looked from me to Kevin, making no secret of the fact that he didn't find us all that trustworthy.
"How come you dress like a man?" he asked me.
"Nigel," said Kevin quietly,
"don't worry about how she's dressed. Just go get some help for your friend."
"Friend?" Nigel gave Kevin a frightened glance,
then looked at Rufus.
"Go, Nigel," whispered Rufus. "It hurts something awful. Say I said for you to go."
Nigel went, finally, unhappily. "What's he afraid of?" I asked Rufus. "Will he get into trouble for leaving you?"
"Maybe."
Rufus closed his eyes for a moment in pain.
"Or for letting me get hurt. I hope not. It depends on whether anybody's made Daddy mad lately."
Well, Daddy hadn't changed. I wasn't looking forward to meeting him at all. At least I wouldn't have to do it alone. I glanced at Kevin. He knelt down beside me to take a closer look at Rufus's leg.
"Good thing he was barefoot," he said. "A shoe would have to be cut off that foot now."
"Who are you?"
asked Rufus. "My name's Kevin. Kevin Franklin."
"Does Dana belong to you now?"
"In a way," said Kevin. "She's my wife."
"Wife?"
Rufus squealed. I sighed. "Kevin, I think we'd better demote me. In this time..."
"Niggers can't marry white people,"
said Rufus. I laid a hand on Kevin's arm just in time to stop him from saying whatever he would have said. The look on his face was enough to tell me he should keep quiet. "The boy learned to talk that way from his mother," I said softly, "and from his father, and probably from the slaves themselves."
"Learn to talk that way?"
asked Rufus. "About niggers," I said. "I don't like that word, remember? Try calling me black or negro or even colored."
"What's the use of saying all that? And how can you be married to him?"
"Ruth, how'd you like people to call you white trash when they talk to you?"
"What?"
He started up angrily, forgetting his leg, then fell back.
"I am not trash," he whispered. "You damn black..."
"Hush, Ruth." I put my hand on his shoulder to quiet him. Apparently, I'd hit the nerve I'd aimed at. "I didn't say you were trash. I said, how'd you like to be called trash? I see you don't like it. I don't like being called nigger either." He lay silent, frowning at me as though I was speaking a foreign language. Maybe I was. "Where we come from," I said, "it's vulgar and insulting for whites to call blacks niggers. Also, where we come from, whites and blacks can marry."
"But it's against the law."
"It is here, but it isn't where we come from."
"Where do you come from?"
I looked at Kevin.
"You asked for it," he said.
"You want to try telling him?" He shook his head.
"No point."
"Not for you, maybe. But for me..." I thought for a moment, trying to find the right words. "This boy and I are liable to have a long association, whether we like it or not. I want him to know."
"Good luck."
"Where do you come from?" repeated Rufus. "You sure don't talk like anybody I ever heard."
I frowned, thought, and finally shook my head. "Ruth, I want to tell you, but you probably won't understand. We don't understand ourselves, really."
"I already don't understand," he said. "I don't know how I can see you when you're not here, or how you get here, or anything. My leg hurts so much I can't even think about it."
"Let's wait, then, when you feel better."
"When I feel better, maybe you'll be gone. Dana, tell me."
"All right, I'll try. Have you ever heard of a place called California?"
"Yeah. Mama's cousin went there on a ship."
"Luck. Well, that's where we're from. California. But it's not the California your cousin went to. We're from a California that doesn't exist yet, Rufus. California of 1976.
"What's that?"
"I mean, we come from a different time, as well as a different place. I told you it was hard to understand."
"But what's 1976?
"That's the year. That's what year it is for us when we're at home."
"But it's 1819. is 18, 19, everywhere.
You're talking crazy. No doubt. This is a crazy thing that's happened to us. But I'm telling you the truth. We come from a future time and place. I don't know how we get here. We don't want to come. We don't belong here. But when you're in trouble, somehow you reach me, call me, and I come. Although, as you can see now, I can't always help you. I could have told him about our blood relationship. Maybe I would if I saw him again when he was older. For now, though, I had confused him enough.
This is crazy stuff, he repeated.
He looked at Kevin.
You tell me. Are you from California?
Kevin nodded.
Yes. Then are you Spanish? California is Spanish.
It is now, but it will be part of the United States eventually, just like Maryland or Pennsylvania.
When?
It will become a state in 1850.
But it's only 1819. How could you know?
He broke off, looked from Kevin to me in confusion.
This isn't real, he said. You're making it all up.
It's real, said Kevin quietly.
But how could it be?
We don't know, but it is. He thought for a while, looking from one to the other of us.
I don't believe you, he said.
Kevin made a sound that wasn't quite a laugh.
I don't blame you.
I shrugged. All right, Ruth. I wanted you to know the truth, but I can't blame you for not being able to accept it either.
1976, said the boy slowly.
He shook his head and closed his eyes. I wondered why I had bothered to try to convince him. After all, how accepting would I be if I met a man who claimed to be from 1819, or 2019 for that matter? Time travel was science fiction in 1976. In 1819, Rufus was right. It was sheer insanity. No one but a child would even have listened to Kevin and me talk about it.
If you know California's going to be a state, said Rufus, you must know some other things that are going to happen.
We do, I admitted. Some things. Not very much. We're not historians.
But you ought to know everything if it already happened in your time.
How much do you know about 1719, Ruth? He stared at me blankly.
People don't learn everything about the times that came before them, I said. Why should they?
He sighed.
Tell me something, Dana. I'm trying to believe you.
I dug back into the American history that I had learned both in and out of school.
Well, if this is 1819...
The president is James Monroe, right?
Yeah.
The next president will be John Quincy Adams.
When?
I frowned, calling back more of the list of presidents I had memorized for no particular reason when I was in school. In 1824, Monroe had, will have, two terms.
What else?
I looked at Kevin. He shrugged.
All I can think of is something I got from those books we looked through last night. In 1820, the Missouri Compromise opened the way for Missouri to come into the Union as a slave state and Maine to come in as a free state. Do you have any idea what I'm talking about, Rufus?
No, sir.
I didn't think so.
Have you got any money?
Money? Me? No.
Well, you've seen money, haven't you?
Yes, sir.
Coins should have the year they were made stamped on them, even now.
They do.
Kevin reached into his pocket and brought out a handful of change. He held it out to Rufus, and Rufus picked out a few coins.
1965, he read. 1967? 1971? 1970? None of them say 1976.
None of them say 18 anything either, said Kevin.
But here. He picked out a bicentennial quarter
and handed it to Rufus.
1776?
1976, the boy read.
Two dates.
The country's 200 years old in 1976, said Kevin. Some of the money was changed to commemorate the anniversary. Are you convinced?
Well, I guess you could have made these yourself.
Kevin took back his money. You might not know about Missouri, kid, he said wearily, but you'd have made a good Missourian.
What?
Just a joke. Hasn't come into fashion yet. Rufus looked troubled.
I believe you. I don't understand like Dana said, but I guess I believe.
Kevin sighed. Thank God. Rufus looked up at Kevin and managed to grin.
You aren't as bad as I thought you'd be.
Bad? Kevin looked at me accusingly. I didn't tell him anything about you, I said.
I saw you, said Rufus. You were fighting with Dana just before you came here. Or it looked like fighting. Did you make all those marks on her face?
No, he didn't, I said quickly. And he and I weren't fighting.
Wait a minute, said Kevin. How could he know about that?
Like he said, I shrugged. He saw us before we got here. I don't know how he does it, but he's done it before. I looked down at Rufus. Have you told anyone else about seeing me?
Just Nigel.
Nobody else would believe me.
Good. Best not to tell anyone else about us now either. Nothing about California or 1976. I took Kevin's hand and held it. We're going to have to fit in as best we can with the people here, for as long as we have to stay. That means we're going to have to play the roles you gave us.
You'll say you belong to him?
Yes. I want you to say it, too, if anyone asks you.
That's better than saying you're his wife.
Nobody would believe that.
Kevin made a sound of disgust. I wonder how long we'll be stuck here, he muttered. I think I'm getting homesick already.
I don't know, I said, but stay close to me. You got here because you were holding me? I'm afraid that may be the only way you can get home.
Three. Rufus's father arrived.